Anymore, it seems, energy and volatility go hand in hand. Just look at what's happened during the 3 months the General Assembly has been in session. Gas prices have soared and an earthquake devastated one of Japan's nuclear power plants, renewing concerns about the safety of an energy source that had been gaining public support. Hi, I'm John Schwanis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, we'll examine some of the highly charged energy-related issues facing the General Assembly. Does Indiana's energy future lie in coal and natural gas or in renewable alternatives? Is the state moving any closer to getting its first nuclear power plant? And what changes, if any, await the agency that regulates Indiana's public utilities? All that and more on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house.
The idea economy is here at the Purdue Research Park. We collaborate with companies like Scale Computing, one of the country's most promising new companies. Scale Computing, the next generation of data storage. The idea economy is here.
Lawmakers introduced a long list of energy-related bills this session, dealing with everything from coal gasification, utility rate changes, and so-called net metering, to renewable energy standards, the manner in which the state's utility regulators are chosen, and the use of eminent domain to secure land for carbon dioxide pipelines. Some of the proposals didn't go anywhere, but others have produced plenty of sparks. In fact, remember Monsters, Inc., the 2001 Disney movie in which a utility captures kids' screams to produce power? Well, I wish we could bottle the energy generated by this discussion, because it promises to be, well, electric. Joining me are Republican Senator Beverly Gard of Greenfield, chair of the Senate Energy and Environmental Affairs Committee, Democratic Senator Gene Brough of Indianapolis, and a member of that panel, Stan Penninger, President and CEO of the Indiana Energy Association, and Jesse Carbonda, Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. That was my favorite introduction, by the way, of any roundtable this season. Had to get a Disney movie in there.
So, and that was a great movie.
Our young audience will be tuning in for that one. You know, thanks all for being here. These are important issues, and certainly in the news, the headlines have shown just how important they are in recent weeks. And that's where I want to start this discussion, this volatility question when it comes to energy. It seems to me, and you could say this about a lot of public policy issues, but it's a constantly moving target. I remember back in the 2008 presidential campaign when John McCain said the three biggest issues in this campaign are fuel prices, and by the time the election rolled around, prices were down and nobody was talking about it. Bev Gard, you've been dealing with these issues for a long time. Is it hard to make policy because of these constant fluctuations in pricing and in public opinion?
It's very difficult. You have a lot of the policy driven by the administration in Washington, which we see now is very different than the previous administration. Current events, such as the tragedy that we're seeing in Japan, is going to have an effect on the energy policy that we're working on this year and probably for the future. So, yes, it's very difficult. Moving target.
You'd agree with that, Gene Brough? It's hard to come up with a baseline of...
I would in other states, but I think in Indiana, I'm afraid, we don't move nearly fast enough. I think we're tend to be more staid, and if you look at some of the numbers, we tend to fall on the lower end of any real new changes to energy policy and any energy program. So where I think perhaps we should be, it should be a more fluid activity because things are constantly changing. I think we're so embedded in some of our positions that we don't move quite as quickly as other states do, and I think as much as we should.
Is that because of Indiana's reliance, long-standing reliance on coal, for instance, or are you saying that it's more traditional in terms of the types of sources of energy that
we certainly do have a strong reliance on coal, and rightly so, because we have quite a bit of it here in our state. So it only makes sense that we would have a reliance upon it, but at the same token, we found that there are concerns with coal with regard to how much, is it clean enough? Does it produce carbons? And are there other factors to it that then say that we should start to maybe diversify our energy portfolio? But we tend to stay committed to coal and not as committed to some of the other alternatives that are out there.
And, of course, one question that comes to mind as you say that is, as we look at the recent rules that were handed down, proposed by the EPA, that deal with mercury emissions from traditional coal plants and so forth, and other toxins. Stan Penninger, that's for your industry, that would be a complete game changer. Is that
well,
a fair assessment?
Well, it is. It absolutely is. And we've dealt with SO2 and NOx and particulates. Those were early requirements from the EPA dating back to the 70s. And now we're with the new administration and a very aggressive EPA, we're venturing into not only mercury and other emissions, but also waste and water issues. They're going to have a dramatic impact on coal-fired generation. And actually, Senate Bill 251 gets at part of that. One portion of that bill deals with federal mandates that are being pushed down on particularly investor-owned electric coal-fired utilities. And we're big proponents of that portion of the bill, which we believe allows us to more effectively and cost-effectively manage those requirements get at that more quickly, deal with the costs that are associated with complying with those mandates in a more efficient manner, and in the long run, save our customers money.
I definitely want to dig into 251 because that is probably the granddaddy of the bills in terms of the attention and the scope that we've seen this session on the environmental and, I should say, the energy front. But let me get your take real quick, Jesse Carbonda, on the EPA's long-awaited rules. This is the old rules, which weren't as stringent, had been tossed out by court. They go back to the original President Bush administration. I take it you're pleased by what you saw in recent weeks.
We are, and I think that you pointed to a very appropriate phrase of long-awaited. I mean, there has been a need for many years to adopt strong public health safeguards on mercury and other toxins, and particularly for a state like Indiana, which ranks so high because of our heavy dependence on coal on these toxins in terms of per capita exposure. I think Spencer County is ranked 18th out of 2,000 counties in the entire country in terms of the amount of mercury exposure it gets. And one of the arguments you're going to likely hear regarding this type of federal policy is that it's going to be detrimental to Hoosiers or to Americans in general. But basically, every benefit cost analysis study that's done by independent economists show that the benefits that are derived in terms of public health improvements far exceed the compliance costs.
And
go ahead.
And I have spoken to members of Mr. Penninger's organization who agree that these are, I don't think there's any refuting the fact that these are some good policies that are coming down from the EPA. I think where we differ is the way in which those policies are paid for and adopted at a state level.
Can we actually get you going on record saying there are good policies coming from the EPA?
No, not today.
I didn't think that might have been a stretch.
Well, I've spoken to some of your members, and there are some of them that they think are pretty good.
You might as well jump in there, Stan.
Well, thank you. You know, we're working aggressively in Washington to try to make an impact on many of these rules. And as I mentioned, it's not just it doesn't just stop here with the rule that was announced yesterday with regard to mercury. There are further ozone restrictions in the pipeline. There are which involves further reductions in SO2 and NOx. There are coal ash provisions being considered by EPA, as well as a substantial water requirement, all focused on coal-fired generation. And as you pointed out, historically and presently, we're heavily reliant on coal generation in Indiana. I think the public policy of our legislature has, in fact, advocated continued coal use in Indiana. And I know our governor is a huge advocate of coal. So it's something we're going to have to deal with. This isn't going to change overnight. There certainly are other sources of baseload generation. You know, you think of natural gas and nuclear. The nuclear conundrum is ongoing, and natural gas is because of the current price of natural gas and the abundance of supply is viewed as sort of a bridge between coal and other baseload generation sources. So, you're right. It's a fluid situation, and it changes. It seems, if not yearly, certainly within a matter of years that the philosophies change.
Well, you mentioned nuclear, so that's probably a good segue perhaps to one of the highest profile elements of Senate Bill 251,
correct,
which is BevGuard, your bill. I want to talk about all the elements, but let's start with this notion that this bill is designed to spur construction of a nuclear plant in, or at least that's what you intended it, of a nuclear power plant in Indiana. It hasn't had one. Neighboring states do, west, east, and north. Where do you stand on that now in light of what we've seen in Japan?
You know, I think at this point we're probably going to need to step back and let this whole tragic situation play out. Let the scientists do their job, figure out what went wrong, how in the future nuclear can be provided to the public in at least a much safer way. What we have to realize, we're talking about a 40-year-old plant in Japan using 50-year technology. So the types of systems that we're talking about now are probably engineered very differently than that facility was. But what I've tried to do in 251, and I've worked with Senator Hirschman and Senator Merritt on this, is to provide a whole scope of different approaches to energy policy in Indiana, bringing the nuclear to the state, looking at renewables, not from a mandate, but from a more market-based approach, encouraging renewables, providing incentives for utilities to utilize those incentives.
Your goal, and I'll interrupt just to say, your goal is 10% by 2025.
By 2025, yes. And the burden is absolutely on the utilities in this to meet those goals by 2010. Provide incentives for in Indiana generation. We provide incentives for demand side management and energy efficiency. Those are all part of the portfolio. But also with the environmental mandates, we think it's really important that utilities retrofit our existing, which is a very old fleet of coal plants, to meet those environmental mandates. If they don't, those plants are they're not going to be around in another 20 years. And we have huge energy demands that at the present we're not going to be able to meet by 2025.
Well, let's and we'll take these one by one, because you brought up several different elements there that are very interesting and are really at the heart of the discussion
right.
This session. Let me, before we leave nuclear power, does anybody disagree that it's off the table for the session, or B, that it should be off the table? Does anybody here still think it should move forward on
standards? Well, that's certainly a decision that policymakers need to consider, and there's a lot to consider right now. I would mention that Indiana does benefit, at least in northeast Indiana, from a nuclear plant in Bridgman, Michigan, Indiana-Michigan Power.
The Cook plant, yeah.
And 75% of the power that's generated there either directly through I&M customers or on the wholesale level, ends up in Indiana. And that is a plant that has gone through relicensing through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they're in a process of needing to upgrade and provide some safety upgrades at that plant. And there is a provision in Senate Bill 251 which will help facilitate that.
Although, wasn't that plant just shut down in recent days temporarily because of a hydrogen leak?
Well, it was.
Probably doesn't necessarily fit into the argument here.
Well, that may be.
Maybe it does.
Maybe that's another argument for at least the requirements that the NRC has provided for that plant to continue the upgrades, and it's about safety at that plant.
And all of those are arguments for me as to why I agree with Senator Long and Senator Gard and others who think that it's time that we should take nuclear off the table, step back a minute, and really evaluate it. When we have a facility that is so fraught with risk and there are other alternatives that would really diminish the risk factor, I think we have to take that into consideration, particularly when we look at making policy.
And in terms of plant construction and spurring this kind of construction to meet the increased need,
right,
Senator, that you referred to, part of this bill, as I understand it, would shift the risk, if you will, for upfront construction from investors of public utilities to current ratepayers, so that the utilities basically, to put it in the simplest terms, get their money up front and don't have to wait for the return. I mean, and I want to hear your take, but Jesse, you've been silent for a few moments. Is that the right way to approach this?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we've argued that there's an appropriate existing regulatory framework for them to seek reimbursement of their costs. We're concerned about the In addition to the safety issues that have been noted by several of the panelists, we're concerned about how this kind of distorts the economics of making an accelerated transition to a clean energy economy. One of the pieces which you alluded to, John, is this issue of advanced reimbursement called trackers or accelerated cost recovery. We're concerned about how that might essentially delay rapid integration of renewable energy into the electricity portfolio. That's one of our concerns. The other question is, we have not seen any hard evidence from the utilities, and I've actually asked three different investor-owned utilities over the last 2 years for this information about whether trackers truly is a net benefit to the consumer. Because the thing is, if you're prepaying the costs, as in the case of construction work in progress or trackers, then a consumer is essentially foregoing using that money to make another investment. And so they actually may end up neutral or worse off in the case of construction work in progress or trackers. And furthermore, there's reduced oversight from our standpoint of trackers, which might actually lead to even greater costs. So we're just not convinced that that mechanism is actually beneficial for businesses and residents.
And I should point out, you recently, I know you had a video call to arms on your website where you went so far as to call Senate Bill 251 a complete joke. Now with Senator Gard sitting here, you're sticking with that?
Well, what I said was a complete joke, and I did say that, was with respect to the renewable energy provisions, that we felt that the bill as it came out of Senate Utilities was not really going to create a robust market for renewable energy. It changed on the floor, but there are still some serious deficiencies in the bill, primarily because there's no requirement, and I would love to elaborate.
All but 14 states, and again, correct me if I'm wrong on this, all but 14 states have specific mandates for the goal. Well, I guess you can have a mandated goal. It's still a goal, somewhat nebulous, but the states, all but 14, have said, we want to get to this point with alternative sources of energy by X date. You're advocating this more voluntary, incentive-based
approach. A market-based approach, and what you're seeing in some of these states is they're beginning to pull back from that because they realize that the mandates are not achievable, the percentages that they have required of renewables. So some of those states are beginning to pull back. But if we're advocating a market-based approach, and we want to have a very diverse portfolio of renewables. The wind people have been very aggressive in trying to get a wind mandate. But one of the things that I think it's very important for people to understand, when the wind doesn't blow, you don't get power. When the sun doesn't shine, you don't get solar energy. When you have a drought and the rivers, the river flow is diminished, you can't produce hydro power. So for every megawatt of renewable energy, you have to have a base load generation back there to back that up, because we're not going to get manufacturers in this state if, when they turn the switch, the power doesn't come on.
John, I'd like to quickly respond to that. Several points that Senator Gard made there. One is, first of all, 30 states have renewable requirements, 7 have voluntary requirements. Of the 30 that have requirements, 10 actually upgraded their requirements because they were successful. There were 2 states that recently tried to repeal it, but it was simply an effort in committee that died. So the national trend continues to be towards robust requirements. Another thing, and this is a very important point, we would maintain that a renewable electricity standard is actually a very compelling free market mechanism. The basic stipulation is to say X percent of our electricity needs to come from renewables. But beyond that, you have a variety of different renewable energy suppliers who have to bid competitively to meet those certain targets. Why we're very keen on seeing a requirement is it's actually cheaper for customers. And the reason, of course, is that if you have a requirement and a wind developer is choosing between a number of different states, it's going to go towards a state where there's a requirement because it's going to reduce its project financing, and that's going to lead to lower rates for customers. The other thing is that Iowa, 15% of its electricity comes from renewable energy. So to say that, you know, it's not plausible to have a significant percent of its electricity from renewables is just not true.
Told you there'd be energy. Everybody wants to talk. We only got about 2 minutes left, so we got to talk.
And I just wanted to say, you know, my concern with the construction work in progress is a lot of these, the reason why they're reverting to the ratepayers is because these are still new technologies, and it's difficult for investors to actually make the financial commitment. So they are, instead of trying to go on the open market and get investors, they're getting those costs through the ratepayer, which is, a very unique way of financing.
I want to ask you about the pipeline.
Can I just talk about, please, the...
If you do it in... Well, very
well,
fast.
The trackers that are involved in Senate Bill 251 are mandated costs that we're going to be facing regardless of whether they're tracked or not. They're going to be paid on the front end, which we think saves customers money in the long run, or they're going to be recovered through a rate case, in which case we've got lots of costs and we're going to experience rate shock. Another...
I don't want to cut you off, but I know this other issue is very important to you, too, and that is this notion of the CO2 pipelines. That was another one of Senator Gard's bills, and what it would have done is taken the byproduct, the CO2, mm-hmm. from gasification mm-hmm. plants and taken it through pipelines down, I guess, to the Gulf of Mexico, where they could use it for...
Enhanced oil recovery.
Hydrofracking. I always like to say that. but now that bill failed on the floor. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think that legislation will come back either later this year or next year. And I think because of what we're seeing in Japan, it even puts more emphasis on the need for coal over at least the short term, because coal is cheaper, it's safer. We're not going to build coal plants unless we're able to deal with the carbon dioxide. This makes a commodity out of carbon dioxide, and I think eventually we'll resolve this issue.
I was very happy that the bill failed. It dealt with some eminent domain issues that just removed the individual property owner out of the process of determining how their property is used, and then hydrofracking. I still had some concerns about hydrofracting in the way that the way that IDEM or some authority agency oversaw just the things that were released from the hydrofracking process.
Now you're all going to get off the hook because I saw that the University of California, mm-hmm. Santa Barbara just came out with a study showing that daylight saving time, the switch to daylight saving time, is costing Hoosiers upwards of $8 million in extra electricity costs. So I was going to propose, is it time to get off of daylight saving time and go back?
No.
Okay, well, that's another show for another time and another session, I guess. Thank you all for being here. Again, my guests have been Republican Senator Beverly Gard of Greenfield, Democratic Senator Jean Brough of Indianapolis, Stan Penninger, President and CEO of the Indiana Energy Association, and Jesse Carbonda, Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. On the next Indiana Lawmakers, with the session entering its final scheduled month, money matters move to the forefront. To join the discussion or pose a question for our guests, visit the Indiana Lawmakers discussion on the WFYI Facebook page. Each week I'll select one of your questions for our panel of experts. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight. I've used up all the quips and energy puns I can, so we'll go straight
I'm
to...
I'm full of energy today.
Jim. All right. I can count on you. You know, we talked in the roundtable about the volatility surrounding energy and how tough it can be, and I think both lawmakers who are here acknowledged it's tough to chase that moving target.
And this is a long-term kind of issue, too. I mean, we've seen this going back to the 1960s and then the 1970s, the debates that we had over the new coal plants back then, over nuclear energy at the Bailey plant and at Marble Hill. We've had that almost every year, it seems, since. And we've not really been able to take the kind of long-term blue-ribbon approach to looking at just what the state's energy needs are beyond, you know, the Purdue University forecasting groups, you know, surveys every couple of years that tell us where we need to be. But we've never really sat down and said, okay, you know, let's look at where we are as a state, where we're going to be economically, what we need to get from one point to the other, what our resources are, and go from there. There's been a lot of that, you know, in an ad hoc way every session, but nothing totally comprehensive.
Given the background you mentioned with the Bailey plant, which was proposed in 1967, and then Marble Hill, which was abandoned in 84, if we sit here and have this discussion in 20 years, will we be saying, oh yeah, there's a nuclear plant in Indiana finally, or will we still be saying, not here?
20 years may be a pretty tight time frame at this point. You know, obviously, you know, with Senate Bill 251 essentially off the table, not only because of the Democratic walkout, but but also because of concerns over what happened in Japan in March. It's going to be a very tough sell, and even the construction deadlines and the ability to get financing for such a project are really difficult in any kind of environment, much less the one that we're in today.
And some political intrigue surrounding one of Senator Gard's bills that we talked about briefly during the roundtable, the notion of using eminent domain for these special CO2 pipelines. The governor has really wanted to see Rockport gasification plant, and it would require, according to the utilities, this kind of eminent domain and these pipelines to make it a go with financers. But yet he lost the battle in his Republican-controlled Senate.
And you can do it without eminent domain, without the special kind of eminent domain authority that they're seeking. We had the Rockies Express, that Rex pipeline, go across the state from Illinois to Ohio in the last couple of years. But they had to do it piecemeal, and it took a long time. It was very expensive. That's why they want the change.
All right, Ed. Thanks very much. As always, appreciate your insights. For more information, episode streams, and extra content, visit us on the web at wfyi.org/lawmakers. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Lawmakers under News. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwanes. Take care.
When bright ideas need world-class infrastructure,
you can discover new ways to treat cancer.
Understand our planet.
Understand our galaxy.
To learn more, visit PurdueResearchPark.com.